have real feet on it, doesn't it?
No feet.
So, why don't we go around and just say our names and maybe just say just a little bit about your connection with meditation practice, if you've been doing it for a while or not. You know, how long have you been meditating in, just so we have a sense of what we're talking about here. So, why don't you begin?
Hello everyone, my name is Patricia, but I go by Pato. Mm-hmm. And I've been connected with meditation more like steady for the last 5 years, mostly Shambhala. Some Zen meditation started me into, and then I got into Shambhala. So. But I remember meditating when I was little with some meditation tapes. I was like 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. So. Hi, my name is Tim. I've been meditating kind of regularly for probably the past 6 or 7 years, and I've been involved with a group here for about the same amount of time. I think I took level 1 in 2007 or so.
My name's Lee, and I've been meditating for about 10 years, I guess, with a steady practice, and moved here about 2 years ago, and been in the Sangha since then.
Adana, and I've been practicing a long time. Trungpa Rinpoche was my first teacher, now Sakya Nipam Rinpoche is my teacher. And we moved to Longmont in August.
I'm John. I started practicing meditation almost a year and a half ago. I just keep exploring and trying to dive in deeper, so it's there.
I'm Barbara, and I used to meditate as a child, but it was out in nature, you know. That's what I was doing, I realized. But so formally, as an adult meditator, I only got 5 years struggling meditator.
Hello, my name's Phil, and I've been meditating for like 37 years in different traditions. Shamanic, yoga, I've been through Shambhala a few different times. Seem to have a variety of practices. But right now, Shambhala and toggling.
And I'm David, and as far as I remember, I think it was around 2007, so I guess maybe 9 years. All in the Shambhala tradition. And I started out at the Baldwin Center, and you know, I really haven't gone further than that since. So it's been good.
Okay. I'm Eric, and I've been meditating irregularly for maybe 20 years or so. And I'm most interested to hear what you have to say tonight, because I always carry around this notion that I should be doing, you know, more than I am. So.
I'm Carol. I've been meditating in the Shambhala tradition for maybe 10 years.
Hello, I'm Brana. Recently moved to Longmont. This is my first time here at this meditation center. I've been irregularly meditating in the Shambhala tradition in upstate New York for maybe 5 years. Mm.
I'm Richard, and I've been meditating in Shambhala for about 6 years, pretty regular.
And I'm Roland, and I was also a student of Chögyam Trungpa, the founder of Shambhala, so I've been doing this a long time, and also on again, off again, especially in the beginning. So that's why I came up with this title, because I thought it was a provocative one. Does everyone know what tonight's talk is about? It's called, Why Can't I Meditate? With the subtext, creating, and what was it? What did it say under that? establishing a practice, regular practice, in the midst of resistance. Yes. So, has anyone here ever experienced resistance to meditation?
No.
No, I didn't. Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Oh, you're the only one. No one else bothered to even raise their hand. Yeah. Well, if you didn't ever experience resistance, it would be rather strange. Because the whole point here is that there's some kind of challenge in the practice of meditation. You know, it's actually challenging us to be with what we usually avoid to be with, which is ourself, or our, we could just say, our, just being and not actually doing anything other than being with ourself, which, you know, for a lot of us, the way we were raised and our culture, the message of our culture, it's rather counterintuitive to be a meditator. I remember in the early days, back in the 70s, if you said you meditated, people really looked at you strangely. And if you, like, my mother used to, you know, introduce me to her friends, and she said, "This is my son, the Buddhist," like that. And he's a Buddhist, like that. And it was actually a conversation piece, going into cocktail parties or whatever, and the dentists and things like that. So now, of course, you know, meditation, we might even call it mic meditation, it's everywhere. And sometimes it's very much based upon wisdom traditions, such as ours. And sometimes it's based more upon a model of health and relaxation and everything in between. And sometimes it's actually based on ETs and astral projection. So it could be any number of things. But in terms of meditating in the style that we talk about meditating, which is really doing nothing properly, as Trigam Trungpa put it, doing nothing properly and fully. And discovering, because we're not doing anything, discovering what we do. When we don't do anything, we discover all the things that we do all the time. Our mind, what all the things our mind does, all the things our heart and mind does constantly. We sit with that. We be with that. And the big message here in Shambhala, or the main message we could say, is that fundamentally, there's really no problem with our existence. Fundamentally, we are no different than the Buddha. We're no different than what we call, you know, a completely realized or awake person. That is our nature already. So meditation, from our point of view, is really just giving into our true nature, or realizing or seeing our true nature, or allowing ourselves to rest so that we can not fight our true nature, which is oftentimes what we're doing. So this is, I think, brings us right into the topic of resistance, because why would it be, if it's our true nature to be simply who we are, how we are awake, with no problem, meaning that we actually can connect fully with our world, connect fully with others, connect fully with each thing that we're doing, we could experience with tremendous depth and fullness and total involvement and total integrity. That's possible for us. So why would that produce resistance if that's really what we are opening towards? Why would we feel resistance to that, since it's our basic nature? I'm going to ask, put that question out to as a teaser. And why don't you just think about that for a minute? You could say something if something occurs to you.
Maybe like the issue of worthiness, that, you know, if I sat with myself, I might discover things that are not, that don't feel worthy. So it's just a fear of the unknown, in a sense. Mm. If I haven't really been raised to be with myself, then who the hell is that, and what am I going to find? So.
Okay. Good. Anyone else?
I think that a lot, that at least it was for me, when I first started meditating, I really didn't believe in myself. So, kind of like what Barbara was saying, the hesitancy to really... I didn't believe in basic goodness. I didn't really believe in it. I said it. But then I looked at myself and all of the ungood things that I could find about myself, and that was what I focused on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good.
I think there's a lot of cultural pressure not to just sit and be with ourselves. Everything about our culture demands that we do otherwise. Mm-hmm. And perhaps in some cultures it's far more acceptable to just be quiet and be present and see what's there inside, but certainly not in American culture, maybe even Western culture.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. I think I'm like an addiction to external stimulus, like wanting excitement and wanting, I don't know, whatever, wanting to taste things and wanting entertainment and I think that's for me.
I don't have much problem once I'm on the mat. I like it, actually. It's actually getting there.
Yeah.
That's hard for me, and it's because I love my distractions. Mm-hmm.
Seeking pleasure. I like to seek pleasure rather than going to the pain or whatever's there. And also creating security. I should be making more money or building a wall or something.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea. Yeah.
Not me, but
Could you folks move back a little bit so we're not in a line and we can see you better? More of a circle. Thank you.
I wanted to just mention habit. I have all these years of practicing avoiding being with yourself. And so in the absence of any kind of discipline, you just go back and follow that habit again.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Anything else?
I think sort of thinking that we've seen it all, and kind of the sense that, what's going on here is not necessarily what's interesting. I think it's sort of that pleasure, that entertainment focus, where there must be something else other than this, and I sure better get going after it, because life's short, kind of thing. So.
Yeah. Excellent.
Avoiding boredom, I guess. That would be a way to put it in, just to not wanting to meet boredom.
Yeah.
Hmm.
The thought that this is all there is strikes me with panic sometimes. Mm-hmm. The groundlessness, the nothingness of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I do become very aware that there really is nothing solid, and that's frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I like what you said about, one of you said something about money, making money. I mean, our society has us wound up so tight that we can't slow down for a moment. We have to be making money, we have to be spending money, we should just really slow down. But it's hard. I mean, trying to keep up with society.
And yes. Just functioning normally in society. It's set up so you have to spend a lot of your time working just to baseline, pay the rent.
Yes, so meditation practice, we could say puts a monkey wrench into the process of being successful at fixating on things. it makes it difficult to be good at that anymore. And when we start to realize the truth of it, first maybe, you know, we get into meditation because we feel that there's more, or we feel totally crazy and we want to find something to help us. There could be many reasons that we get into it. But from the basic level of just feeling there's more and I want to find it, or just some kind of inquisitiveness, all the way to desperation of feeling that, hey, I'm going to die and I want to understand what's going on. So, meditation practice leads us to, seeing the hopelessness of building our habits, and, you know, sort of shows us that we can't really win at this game of samsara, of this game of confused existence, that even if we win for briefly, that's going to fall apart. So, you know, we actually are, by meditating, we're beginning to see how things really work. And as we see how things really work, it's very hard for us to be quite so convinced in the validity of this game that we're asked to play, which is very competitive and very much based on that there is such a thing as real security that's lasting, you know, in a kind of a, from the point of view of a materialistic sense, or, you know, that we could get comfortable and never have to work again, that we could get comfortable and feel that we have arrived and that we're one of the winners, basically, not a loser. So we're kind of addicted to that particular approach and message. Also, I think, you know, someone talked about the groundlessness quality of meditation practice. I mean, generally speaking, it's interesting that that when we, the more and more we practice, the more we actually long for openness, the more we desire that spaciousness because we've tasted it. And because we've tasted it, there is a alternate motion, which is the feeling of a kind of a, what's the word for it when you have, remember the good old days, what's that called?
Nostalgia.
Yeah. There tends to be like a nostalgia sometimes for when we weren't so challenged with being with what's coming up in each moment. We weren't so challenged with actually seeing what we're doing. Rather, we could ignore what we're doing and just sort of go after something. How nice, how friendly, how sweet. Sort of like, you know, the in Lord of the Rings, the hobbits, you know. They're so kind of human and involved in their beautiful little human rituals, and they're so sweet and lovely in a very ignorant way, but there's something wonderfully comfortable about that. You see them with their pipes and their, you know, little ways of doing things that are very kind of predictable and very friendly and very secure, seemingly. And so there's this sense that we kind of are in love. We've been sold that image as being a pinnacle of really, you know, what we could achieve in this life, some kind of, you know, just go along and feel like we're not too challenged by anything, that we actually can be safe, can feel safe. So then if you take the story of the hobbits a little further and you have this person, Frodo, who goes on this journey, which is the opposite of safe, and he has two friends that go with him, but essentially Frodo's the one that has to, you know, really lean into it because he's carrying the ring, right? And interestingly, he goes through this intense journey of facing all of his demons. And he has to face everything, doesn't he? And then in the end, when he goes back to Hobbit Town or whatever it's called, the Shire, you know, he can't stay there. Nor can his father, who also, his uncle, who also, Bilbo Baggins, right? They have to go. They have to leave with the, what are they called? The Elves, yeah. Because they've seen too much that that world of security, you can't play that game anymore once you've seen too much. So on one level, you know, you enter into the real world, which is really profound and is a continuous journey and is challenging you all the time in the most delightful way, because actually there's a sense of continuously, there's a joy in being able to relate with things and not have to come up with a strategy to not relate with it. That struggle that we always have to come up with a strategy to either get what we want or not, you know, get away from what we don't want, is actually, you know, it's extraordinarily painful for us. We're caught, we're stuck in this game that we play all the time. So that, you know, journey, on the one hand, we identify, by the end of the movie, you identify with the hero, the heroic aspect, right, of him having gone through all this, really for the benefit of the whole world. But he can't stay at home. He can't be a homie anymore. It's how painful, you know? And at the same time, how completely true to life. You know, in Buddhism, we say once you get to a certain point of really feeling that this path, you want to go all the way, this is your path, and you really want to commit to it. In Buddhism, you do something called take refuge. You actually become a Buddhist, which means, you know, you rely upon the authentic example of enlightened being, the Buddha, and also great teachers who are also great examples. And then you rely upon authentic community that aren't just interested in scratching each other's itch, but are actually interested in waking up. And then you rely upon the practice and the study of the way to do these, of the way to actually take the journey and to do it. And the interesting thing is when you, this kind of refuge is, you know, a refuge, we could say, it's a refuge away from ignorance. It's taking refuge in wakefulness. It's actually becoming, we say, a refugee, becoming a refugee. So, naturally, when we're still in the world, maybe it's a little easier, maybe, if you're not in the world anymore, like you're in a monastery or in a cave, and you've just decided, this is what I'm going to do. And there's nothing around you to kind of seduce you into, you know, back to your habits of believing that there's something that's going to make me happy other than facing reality. So long as we are doing this, it is extraordinarily challenging to be in the world and be a refugee at the same time. And yet, according to our traditions, this is what's essential to do. And also, it's the quickest path to waking up. Because if you're in a cave, you know, you might make a little nest out of that. That could become your kind of habit. It could happen that you sort of feel like, well, at least I don't have to deal with all those crazy materialists anymore. Of course, what you're not seeing is what they provoke in you, the materialism they provoke in you, which is why it's much more challenging to be in the world, because you get provoked constantly. But when we are on the path, at some point, you know, very soon into beginning to practice, we begin to wonder, we begin to have lots of doubts about what we're doing. We begin to wonder, you know, what am I doing? What am I, you know, do I really want to do this? At some point you actually might even really have a crisis where you go, wait a minute. do I actually want to step out of my comfort zone all the time? Or do I want to keep it kind of handy for when I feel a little bit, you know, tired or lazy and I need my habits to make myself feel, you know, happy? So, you know, naturally we start to feel at some point that this maybe has become unreasonable, that the journey, the demand on us is becoming unreasonable. And that, you know, I need 75% of the time I could do this, but 25% of the time I'd like to have something where I could get out of this constant waking up process and actually just go to sleep and feel like I can go back to my sort of dream, you know, familiar dreams and familiar reference points, and lull myself in a sense of that there's a continuity to that I can depend upon, as though there were. Of course there isn't, but we would like there to be. So we end up, you know, going back and forth. Generally, most of us do. Most of us go back and forth. We go forward, and then we feel like we're standing on the edge of a cliff. And some of us, we feel like, you know, very kind of challenged by what we're doing, by the path, by meditation practice. And, you know, there you are in the morning, and it's another day. And there's your cushion, and you go, gee, maybe later. Yeah, I could do this later. I've got this really good energy about this today, and I don't want to undermine it by meditating. I don't want to, like, cut that momentum that I already feel going, because I really feel like I could get some things done today. It's such a beautiful day, and I'm in the energy of this day already, and if I meditate, I don't know what will happen. So that's one kind of resistance that comes up for a lot of us, is that we have this choice that we make. Right? That's one way that we get away with not meditating. We establish a pattern of not meditating, is we leave it as a choice. We leave it as a choice. And then we have to make the choice. And if you have to make a choice to practice, very often you're going to choose not to. I mean, that's just how it goes. I mean, every teacher that I've ever heard talk about it says, you know, you have to make it a habit or else it's not going to fly. One teacher said, you know, it's a lot like becoming an alcoholic. Becoming a practitioner is like becoming an alcoholic. If you really want to be a good alcoholic, you have a drink every night. And before you know it, you have to have another drink the next day. You know, before you know it, you're an alcoholic. That's how it works with practice, the same way. If you practice some every day, before you know it, it's something that you miss. You actually want, you go, if you don't practice, you go, something's wrong, what is it? Oh, yeah, there isn't that gap, that feeling of spaciousness. So, yeah, so it's very important for us to establish practice as a habit. That's one thing. Then there's another common way that we don't practice. And I just lost my train of thought completely. Let me try to think, get it back. What was it? Yeah.
Can I get an example of me?
Yeah, yeah.
I got to get stuff done this morning before it gets too hot. So everything I got to do has got to be before it gets too hot in the day. I just feel too depressed. I can't. You know, I just. Maybe if I take a walk or something and I come back, then I could. Mm-hmm. I could sit.
Right.
Laundry.
Yeah. Good.
Maybe I could, like, put the laundry in and then come back.
Right.
And sit.
Right.
You know, and then when the time's up, I'll go back out. That'll be good. That's like 20 minutes of sitting. Okay. So, yeah, there's all these little things that I create and believe, actually, which is really funny.
You know what that's
because
called?
Because I know that I've made them all up, but I still go, yeah, you know? Yeah, that's right.
And you know what that's called? It's called procrastination.
Yeah.
Procrastination. So the other one that happens, I just remembered what I was going to say, is that, and this is really common, I think, is if you ask someone, what, you know, how's your practice going? And they say, well, I really haven't had time. I just got so much on my plate right now. I don't have time. And there's a feeling maybe to their life that they really don't have feeling. They really feel, you know, this kind of, you know, pressurized by demands, and that there's really no time to do anything, let alone meditation. And this is a very interesting one, because actually the feeling of not having time is very much connected with feeling like you don't have space, right? Space and time are generally together, according to Einstein and others. And so, interestingly, meditation, when you practice, even though you're very busy, you at least begin to touch into an experience of space, that there's always space in your world. Because in order for anything to happen, there has to be space for it to happen, to arise. But the problem is, when we're really busy and really fixated on it, we're so fixated on the next thing that we miss that space. We don't see it. We don't experience it as space. We just experience the next thought, the next thing we have to do, the next... And it's a sense of momentum, of speed, that we're caught in this speed. It's the next thing and the next thing. So we actually don't see that there is a gap in there, but we don't experience it. And it's actually through meditation practice that, because we're not acting on all of these impulses that are arising, we do begin to experience that there is space, gaps in our mind, that's not a solid, continuous thing, our thoughts. That there's lots of gaps. And if we allow them to be there, you know, we begin to experience some kind of relaxation, because there's space finally in our mind. And space in our mind equals a sense of room to experience our world. Because if our mind is constantly projecting out stuff onto our world, it's very hard for us to experience anything new. We tend to just experience our stuff about what's, you know, our storylines, our agendas, our opinions, all of this speedy stuff that we live in our minds, because we don't experience that space that's actually there, but we don't see it. So this is the paradoxical thing, is that when we feel we don't have any time, that's one of the big reasons we don't meditate, and yet it's meditation practice that actually provides us with a sense of time. So it's really, that's an interesting point that we begin to see if we manage to do it, manage to practice. So I've written down a bunch of tricks that that help us, because I have found that since we're establishing the one habit that undoes all the other habits, or that kind of enables us to see through the nature of habit altogether, but we have to create a habit of that, meditation practice. Or else we can't, we just will never get around to doing it. So here's the kinds of things that I have seen and that I've also heard really help us to do that. So first of all, removing the choice aspect. It's not a choice whether I'm going to meditate. Meditation is done at this time every day, no matter what. No matter what. Now, I did that, you know, I think it was about when I turned 40, or when I was in my 30s, 35, I decided I'm not going to decide to brush my teeth anymore. I'm going to do it no matter what, because I actually want to keep my teeth. And I actually did start doing that. No matter if I got home at 4 a.m., I still went and brushed my teeth and flossed and the whole thing. And it became very easy to do. That was the interesting thing. Doing it every day, it became effortless to do it. So It's the same with meditation, you know. If you're one of those people that actually does schedules, that can actually do a schedule, live by a schedule, then you schedule it in. And you make it serious, a serious thing that you do. You know, you're going to meditate every day at this time. That's one way, for some people that works. Or we could just say, when I wake up, no matter what, first thing I'm going to do is practice, after going to the toilet, after I go to the toilet. And then sometimes people say, after I have my coffee. But never, never say, after I've looked at my emails. No. You're dead. Dead in the water. That won't work. But, you know, so for some people, coffee is acceptable. Necessary. But, doing it first thing in the morning, for some people, that's really the key. And that's the easiest time to do it because your day hasn't, the momentum hasn't started. Mostly, it hasn't started yet. So that's the best time. One time I was at a advanced program with Chögyam Trungpa, which we used to call seminary, Buddhist seminary. And someone raised his hand and said, Rinpoche, I just can't get myself to the cushion. And I just don't know what to do. And he said, well, why don't you sew one to your pants? Wait a minute, this is the wrong sheet here. Here it is. Another really helpful way to establish your practice in spite of, you know, resistance that's going to arise. By the way, you know, resistance is actually extremely intelligent. It's actually extremely intelligent that you resist practice. I left this out. It's really important. It's not that you're stupid or that, you know, how could I possibly resist meditation practice? But it's intelligent because it actually is... you are actually shedding that which is, you know, familiar to you and that which you have treasured for your whole life as being, you know, you, me, these things that I do, these things that I believe. We're actually beginning to see through that whole assumption, the assumptions about all these things. So to actually feel resistance is quite, you know, intelligent in a way, that it's completely new ground that we're stepping onto. It's completely fresh ground. And on the one hand, that freshness is completely delightful, and on the other hand, that freshness can be quite frightening. So no one says that you should just push ahead no matter what. You know, oh yeah, you're having resistance, just push through it. Just push through it. No, actually, the emphasis really needs to be on making friends with yourself. That's what we're doing here. That's what practice is really about. You have to, you know, one of the definitions of meditation practice is it's the practice of non-aggression. That's what we're doing. We're practicing gentleness or non-aggression. The reason it's non-aggression is because gradually we realize that whatever arises, in order for us to see it, we have to let it be as it is. Right? We have to let it be as it is. Whatever arises in our being, instead of picking and choosing and thinking, you know, I like this, I don't like that, in meditation we learn to allow things to come up and be. And because we do that, we are able to then, you know, gradually, we're able to be with any state of mind as it is. And fear comes up, and we learn even to allow that to be, not to try to get rid of that. So, I lost my train of thought again.
Resistance is intelligent.
It's intelligent, yes. Mm-hmm. It's intelligent, thank you, yes. And we would like to... you know, we would like to punish ourselves for having resistance. We think, I'm bad for not meditating. But rather than that, you know, we should just trick ourselves into meditating. And I'm going to tell you about the tricks now. If you can trick yourself into meditating, then once you're on the cushion, you recognize, oh my God, I'm so glad I'm doing this. It is, the hardest part for most of us is getting to the cushion. So sitting with others, this is an obvious way to get yourself to practice, is just make a commitment. And so it's not just a commitment to yourself. You've committed to others that you're going to do it. So it makes it much harder to go back on that. And so go to those regular sittings, wherever they may be, and really make a commitment to doing that. That's one way. Creating in your house, you know, a simple, clean spot with maybe a Dharma book on it. It doesn't have to be a big shrine, but just a spot that is dedicated to meditation practice. This is really important, because if you don't have that, if it's just all clutter, there's no reference point to remind you of your practice. So it's very important to have those reference points. Read like a paragraph of Dharma before you sit. Just something. Read some paragraph or just a little bit of a Dharma book right before you, as you start to sit. This is just if you're trying to kind of establish your practice and you've been feeling a lot of arguments as to why it's okay not to practice. If your mind, if you've come up with logics, if you're at that point where you've come up with logics as to why I don't really need to be practicing these days, then it's very important to study, because you've now come up with a samsaric or confused logic to convince yourself not to, you know, actually connect with your basic goodness. So you need to see an enlightened logic. You need to replace that with an enlightened logic. And that's actually so important. That's what we call the view, having the view, understanding why meditate. If we forget why we're meditating, then it can become, you know, it's actually very kind of intelligent that we stop meditating if we've stopped knowing why we're doing it. You know, if we're just doing it because we think, you know, well, it's going to help me make more money, you know, or we're doing it because we think, well, I'll live longer, you know, whatever our logic is for doing it, but we've actually lost the sense of the immediacy of the actual conundrum we're in, the actual kind of vice that we're in, that we've forgotten that, oh, wait a minute, I'm actually going to die one day. It's all impermanent. And, you know, just the reality of confused existence and how painful it is, if we've forgotten that. Or you could say, conversely, if we've forgotten the upliftedness and joy of connecting with our world and others and our basic goodness, then we need to refresh that. It's absolutely essential, as important as the meditation practice. Study in general. You know, just study in general. Connect your mind with the mind. You know, the thing that's so different about Dharma is that it's the mind of enlightenment that is speaking to you. You know, if you're reading a book written by someone who's hopefully enlightened, pretty enlightened, then everything that you read reflects your own Buddha nature and wakes you up at some point. Maybe you read it at first and you're kind of going, oh God, this is just, I'm not connecting with this at all. And maybe at first that's how it is, but gradually it comes around. Wow, it's 10 to 9. I better shut up. So I'll just go through this list. So also reading Dharma connects you directly with non-aggression, because the very voice of the experience of wisdom is the voice of non-aggression. And again, it reflects your own innate non-aggression so that you can experience it and then have confidence in it, in the truth that is still there. And, you know, it's the Dharma, it's the understanding what's going on that inspires you to make effort towards waking up. It's understanding the nature of the kind of, we could say, the what's the word used? It's kind of the ruggedness or the really badness of samsara. What's the word that's used traditionally? The seeing
revulsion.
The
revulsion for something.
You experience revulsion, mm-hmm. but seeing the, it's like the hopelessness and like the how kind of how aggressive and I can't think of the word, but
the suffering.
Yeah, that the suffering is actually very intense. And remembering that actually can cheer you up, strangely enough. Because you thought that the suffering was because you did something wrong, or you think that you're bad, or you think that, you know, you've forgotten that actually that's the nature of things. And it can really make you realize, oh, wait a minute, I'm caught in this larger kind of tornado here of samsara that I need to address. So I'm going to stop there, and let's have a little discussion. There's a little bit of time left. If you have anything to say.
I wanted to say, one thing that I do is to put flowers on my little shrine. Even if I'm not meditating, there's something about that that seems connected somehow. You know, there's a dignity that I'm adding to that space. And the other thing I just thought of is I'm going to get a couple of little pictures because I don't have this. I've got the little rigged in, but mm-hmm. I don't have the pictures of, you know, Trigun Trungpa yeah. and Sakyong Nipon. Because every time I go into Eric's shrine room, I'm bowing, you know, and I'm sort of remembering stuff. And yeah. now I realize if it's at my shrine, that's what I'm going to be doing. So anyway, it's a little way that I think I could trick myself into.
That's great.
Sort of waking up to that.
That's great.
Yeah. I am a nighttime meditator, so I tend to practice every night as much as I can. And then I have my calendar, too. I have the practice calendar where I write down how long I sat. And so I can see when I fall off the practice. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm not doing very well. And sometimes I'm, like, really happy to see, oh, look at all the time that I've sat. Mm-hmm. And like, so it's kind of like a bittersweet thing to have the calendar to keep me honest. Of like, well, I know. And kind of forgiving myself for not really doing it, the times that I don't do it, and not to be too hyped up also for the times that I'm doing it. So kind of like trying to keep the balance of like, oh, it looks kind of, that's the way it looks. And but it helps me keep the practice.
I think keeping in mind that it doesn't always have to be like this, like a big production, and like so since my meditation practice has kind of helped me see the way I get triggered and what spins my mind off, I really feel like there's a lot of times during the day that I find little moments to go back to the breath and to center myself, and especially at work when, you know, people are pissing me off and I'm just like, I'm starting to go. And it's been through my formal meditation practice that throughout the day I can realize that, and even if it's just for a few moments, it kind of smooths everything out, and it makes me feel better, and it makes me have compassion for the people I'm angry at, and I'm not so angry anymore.
That's great. That's great. It's important to remember, though, to have, you know, a period of actual sitting meditation. Because without that, it's hard to have those moments during the day.
It's that formal meditation that's led me to be able to do that.
Exactly. It enables you to do that. Yeah. That's right.
When I'm having a really hard time, I tell myself, I'm only going to do it for 1 minute.
Yeah.
And then once I start, then...
That's a great trick.
Okay, maybe two.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. For those of you who have a shrine, the trick that I used for many years is just, I said to myself, I'm only going to open and close the shrine every day. I don't have to sit. I just have to open and close my shrine. Just do the chants, open the water and the tea. That's all. And so it gets me sitting down in front of it. I actually did this for years, and it was incredible. Once you're sitting there, you know, Of course you're going to sit. But you don't have to.
I appreciate everything you said for a minute. It's all really helpful. And I'm sitting here thinking, dance keeps coming into my mind. The dance between practice and not practice. You know?
Yeah.
And I think heart has, it's, is interesting, or heart sensitivity, because sometimes when I'm feeling a lot of pain, it feels good to practice. And it's like a relief. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I'm feeling a lot of pain, it's like I'm not going near that. Mm-hmm. You know? So there's something about tuning in with where we are and having the sort of bravery to take whatever that is to the cushion, but to really feel it. I think Sakya Nipam said once, you know, when you walk into the room where you're going to sit, just take a little moment. How are you right now? You know, and that kind of acknowledgement, and then however you are is acknowledged, and then it's kind of easier to put it on the cushion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I call that arriving.
Yeah.
And it's a really important step.
Yeah.
Really important step, yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes we don't want to stop and even do that,
right.
You know. But there is,
sometimes
you know.
Sometimes we can sit down without doing that.
That's right.
You know, it's just the mechanical thing. Okay.
That's right.
Do my practice. Good meditator.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. That reminded me of something else, which is that, you know, I thought you were going to say this, that sometimes the it's a natural thing. It's like in a relationship, there's a natural thing where you're drawn together and then apart.
Mm.
You come close and then you move away.
Mm.
And there's a natural kind of intelligent process of that. You don't just have to feel like I'm a warrior and I'm just going to always do it, you know. Actually, you know, that goes against Fresh Start. You know, Fresh Start says, you know, sometimes if you're practicing diligently, you actually aren't allowing enough of yourself to be there.
Right.
Like what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And you actually have to stop meditating to experience it, to experience your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we actually do need a gap. Like at a Datun, when we did practice for a month, there has to be, according to Trigam Trungpa, we must take the day off. There's a day off in the middle, and you're not allowed to not take it. You're not allowed to meditate that day, even if you want to. Mm-hmm. Because it's part of the discipline to actually experience the fresh start. And you know, and then when you go back to the practice, you know, maybe you've dropped a couple of your kind, a couple of solidifications about the practice that you've been holding on to. Yeah, it's really interesting. So there is a place for this kind of close and a little space, little gaps.
It's a dance again. It's like a waltz.
Yes, it is. Yeah, the waltz. Well, I guess we have to stop. Do you have any announcements? Yeah, very welcome.
I'd like to mention very briefly a couple things coming up. One is the Wake Up event. Do you want to?
Sure. Saturday, May 21st at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church, which is on the at the intersection of Missouri Avenue and South Bross Lane, right across from County Motor Park, from 10 to 4. There's a brochure, flyer rather, on the table. We'd be glad for you to take. It'd be wonderful to see people there. There'll be, I think I said, 13 different presentations that you could take advantage of, and it'll be hopefully a beautiful day. We're talking to God about that.
Boo. Okay, thank you. And later that same day is the first of the Longmont Art Walks. And we're going to have a booth on the street. And any of you are welcome to come and help with it, and also just come by and say hello.
I just had this vision of putting the banner that says The Art of Being Human as being the, why we're in an art walk, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And tomorrow night here is the movie night where we're showing a movie whose title I have forgotten, about mortality.
Being Immortal.
Yeah.
Being mortal.
Mm-hmm. Being mortal, okay.
And that's from 7 to 9.
Yeah. It's not that long a movie.
So I'm reading it for the second time. It's been by a surgeon who because of his family situation, he starts becoming sensitive to how end-of-life care happens, but even more so how physicians aren't trained to help people realize that it's hopeless, basically. Yeah. They keep trying to fix it. It's really very well written.
Should we bow?
Can I say one thing?
Please.
We have a shrine that we're giving away. It just seems appropriate. If anybody wants a house shrine, it's about that big. It's white and it has a glass top.
How deep is it?
I have 21, I think.
You mean from the wall out to where you stand in front of it?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
It's not huge, but
it's pretty good.
It's a heavy box.
Yeah.
Fair. So it's there. If anybody is interested, just see me after. Because we don't sit anymore.
No. Gave that one up a long time ago.
Yeah.